It's the Burt Cohen Show. Of interpretations of what the dream is. Is it America a place where we the people don't really have much say, because heck, we don't know what we're talking about anyway? Leave it to the experts, leave it to the people with the muddied interests. Or should it be for the people? Should there be some kind of populism that's really involved in governing ourselves? Well, our guest today is Elias Isquith, who is an assistant editor at Salon, who focuses on politics. And he's written a very interesting article, provocative article, called that says, "A Left-Wing Tea Party May Be Closer Than You Think." Well, thanks very much for being with us, Elias. And a lot of terms need to be defined as starting out. We've seen the Tea Party for quite some time. What is the Tea Party, and in what ways has it been successful? How is that success measured? Let's start there.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on. In terms of what the Tea Party is, it's, you know, that's actually a kind of a hard question to answer, even though
I know
the movement. Say again?
Oh, I know. It's not easy to define, really.
Yeah, it's not easy to define, even though the movement has been so you know, dominant in politics for much of the past 3 years or so. If you talk to different Republicans and different conservatives, or even, you know, different politicians, really, if you talk to anybody, different people will have a different understanding of what they think the Tea Party is. For my part, I think of the Tea Party as basically the kind of the base of the Republican Party. I don't think it's quite right to say that, you know, when it first came about, a lot of Tea Party people described themselves as, like, previously apolitical, non-political, non-partisan people who were so outraged by President Obama's various initiatives that they felt compelled to take to the streets. I don't think that's quite right. I think most of the people who are in the Tea Party are strongly conservative and more or less always have been. But it is true that there is a tension within the Republican Party between the Tea Party people and what I think it's best to understand as the establishment or the business wing, in terms of maybe not so much specifically on policy, although when it comes to immigration reform they do differ, but a lot of the differences between the two have to do with style and sort of their approach to politics. And that's where the Tea Party's influence is most obvious. I would say the best way to appreciate what the Tea Party has done to American politics is to look at the way that since they came into power in 2011, all substantial activity on the federal level has more or less ground to a halt in terms of legislation. And that's not an accident. It's because a lot of the Tea Party people believe that a well-functioning federal government is sort of contrary to freedom. And then if you look on the state level, where the Tea Party has been very successful, especially in the South, you see that a lot of state governments have really drastically reduced their social spending and at the same time have restricted the rights of the reproductive rights of women and the rights of workers. So I would say the Tea Party can be best understood sort of as the most passionate and rigid element of the Republican Party and sort of the conservative movement in America today.
Interesting. So, you know, just a few short years ago, the Tea Party, I think, would have been considered pretty radical, even within the, you know, the establishment Republican Party. And Elias Isquith, you're saying that now it's really the base of the party. Very interesting that they suddenly have that much power. And we're going to talk a lot in this discussion about the locus of power, the federal government versus at the state and local level. And we're going to be, you know, blending this in with talking about possibility of a left-wing Tea Party rising up. The anger which has drawn so many to the Tea Party, generally middle-class people, strikes me, quite frankly, as really legitimate. I see, you know, and I find it frustrating that the right, I can't even call them conservative, the what used to be considered the far right, like the John Birch Society in the 50s and early 60s, that they've owned this anger. What is the legitimate anger that perhaps possibly the left might be able to tap into, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, to some degree, I think the fact that the Tea Party has, and sort of the radical right, and I think you're correct in describing them that way, you know, the Tea Party, there are links between Tea Party movements and sort of very radical, they're called sovereign citizen movements, and other sort of, you could call them white nationalist movements. So it's certainly true that there's a real radicalism. If not throughout the Tea Party movement, then closer to its fringes than I think anybody who supports it would want to admit to the broader public. But in terms of why they've been so much more successful channeling kind of a populist anger, I think to some degree that's a reflection of having a Democrat in the White House. I think that in general people who feel that their party is not in the White House are more likely to see the powers that be as especially corrupt and in need of challenging. But at the same time, you know, part of the reason the Tea Party movement has had success is because they're, at least on a very broad level, they're tapping into something that the left has not been as successful, I don't think, as you would hope, tapping into, which is a really kind of broad and, in some sense, nonpartisan unhappiness on the part of the American people. With basically our foundational elite institutions, so Congress, the presidency, the White House, the media, the judiciary, really like some of the cornerstones or foundational elements of our society. People at this point in our history, at least, are profoundly skeptical and cynical and disappointed in these institutions. And I think what the left needs to do, and what some of these candidates I wrote about for my Salon article have had success in doing, is trying to channel that anger towards the status quo and redirect it in a way that is not as destructive or as reactionary as the Tea Party's proposed solutions have been, and instead trying to kind of frame it as a an opportunity for working people to assert themselves and to demand that their representatives, both on the left and the right, pay more attention to what we call middle class. You know, as I'm sure you know, something like 80% of Americans think they're middle class, so it's sort of a misnomer.
Right.
But anyway, what we think of middle class interests instead of focusing so much on the concerns of the wealthy and corporations.
Yeah, I wonder about, I mean, the anger is there, I think, legitimately that, I mean, who is this government working for? It doesn't seem to be working for the middle class. That seems pretty clear how the what I've always considered the far right took it over. It's interesting, you know, what is genuinely populist? And actually, maybe we should stop here just for a second and define the term populist before we go any further. How would you define it, Elias?
Yeah, that's a good question. To me, I think of populism, I mean, you can point out specific policies usually, or historically, populists tend to be more skeptical of what you could call Wall Street interests,
mm-hmm.
Free trade. They often, populists, at least again historically, tend to be more skeptical than others might be about immigration. They tend to be more focused on sort of what we think of as kind of meat and potato economic issues, equality, access to opportunity, education, and so forth. But I think in the present, in our era, you know, a lot of this is not, it doesn't transfer over quite so cleanly. I think in a lot of ways, populism, as we talk about it today, is it's a stylistic preference on the part of a lot of people, in the sense of being willing to use the kind of language that if it's not explicitly tied to sort of a class-based analysis of politics, at the very least, it sees politics as a contest between groups of people with divergent interests, where a smaller but more powerful group holds a disproportionate amount of sway and influence over sort of the greater majority of people.
It does seem to be a pretty clear-cut line. If you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Elias Iskwith. We're talking about the possible rise of a left-wing Tea Party. And, you know, in terms of populist movements throughout history, there have certainly been a few. We look at after 1919, the horrible decisions at Versailles after the armistice. It wasn't even that Germany lost, really, but they got, you know, terrible, you know, requirements from the Versailles Treaty, the Germans did. And there did seem to be what I would think of as a populist rage, because they were, but they, the focus was, it was unclear. It seemed, it appears that, there was a legitimate populist rage, but then again, it was manipulated by the very wealthy industrialists. Is there any similarity to that now? I mean, obviously not the the anti-Semitism, but the populist rage being manipulated by wealthy industrialists.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's impossible to ignore the way that certain members of sort of the right-wing 1%, most obviously, I would say the Koch brothers, have embraced the Tea Party movement and the populism, that version of populism. One thing that is sort of interesting or a question that's still debated, although I feel that I come down on one side of it pretty strongly, is when the Tea Party first came around, people wondered how much is this a genuine populist uprising and how much of this is what is called AstroTurf, where powerful corporations and wealthy elites and so forth, people who don't really have much at all to do with the groups that we would consider the engines of populism, embrace the Tea Party and fund it and do their best to basically make what is essentially not a grassroots movement look like it is, and that's where the term AstroTurf comes from. In terms of the degree of co-optation by elites, economic elites, I think the Tea Party is pretty significant. But it's pretty significant, and just as examples of where you see it, I mean, there's a lot of convergence between the Tea Party and let's just call them the Koch brothers as sort of a catch-all for all these people. In terms of views of labor rights, regulation, environmental protections, government assistance to the poor, sort of the real basic economic views of what we think of as the conservative movement today. And, you know, and the question could be, well, why is a supposedly populist Tea Party movement working in concert with what you think of as Koch brothers style elites.
Right.
And I think to some degree the answer to that is that while the Tea Party movement speaks in the language of populism, when people have done studies of the people who are part of the movement, trying to do demographic profiles of the average Tea Partier, what you find is that Tea Partiers are significant. I don't want to overstate it, but they're clearly older, whiter, more male, and crucially wealthier than the average American.
Yes.
So while it wouldn't be correct to see a Tea Partier necessarily as the same as a Koch brother, a Tea Party is very often somebody who has a small business of their own, or at least has significant wealth of their own. So these are people that, when push comes to shove and politics becomes a contest between sort of employers and the employed, or the powerful and the powerless, even if these people aren't quite the Koch brothers, they know which side they're on, and it's not the same side as the people that I would consider more, not the same side as the people who advocate a version of populism that I personally find more appealing.
And I there have been cases of populism, and you know, I have to say, it sounds to me like a lot of the people, I don't know what percentage of the demographic of today's right-wing Tea Party, probably are white male, feel that they're entitled to power, and it sounds an awful lot like the people who lost the war in the 1860s. Now,
Sure. I mean, the one word I would use to describe the Tea Party movement is, and the people who really drive it, is reactionary.
Yes.
I think the best way to understand these people, if you're really trying to simplify it, is to really listen to them. And if you read interviews with these people, Theo Scotchpole from Harvard, a celebrated political thinker and sociologist, wrote a great book where she spoke with a research assistant to lots of Tea Partiers. And she tried her best to really start from scratch and say, okay, what do these people believe, and how do they view the world?
Mm.
And what she found is that these are people who very strongly do think that they're kind of quote-unquote losing their country.
Mm.
And the vision of how the world is, or at least how America is supposed to work, and, you know, obviously all of these are really subjective terms.
Of course.
But their sense of how things are supposed to work has been so challenged by, you know, many things, but I would say that the most obvious of which being having a president named Barack Hussein Obama, who is of color, and especially on social issues, is considerably more liberal than what we've seen for much of the past, I don't know, 30 years or so from presidents. That really made these people, many of these people, millions of these people, in fact, feel that they were losing something that they needed to fight tenaciously to get back. In the same way that people, not to take the analogy too far, but the same way that people in the South during the Civil War felt that their way of life itself was being taken from them.
The Civil War never ended, so it seems.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I look back on my reading of history, populism hasn't always been on the right. I mean, there was, I would think the term populist, I may be wrong, but I'm guessing that the Shays and the Whiskey Rebellions were populist. It was, you know, the debtors taking on the creditors, who was going to run the government, the people who had to pay back the money or the people who were owed the money for the War of Independence. Then fast forward to the 1890s, there was the movement for paper money that could help lower income people. In the 1890s, William Jennings Bryan, and there's the whole democratic farm labor movement. So there is, correct me if I'm wrong, some history of left-leaning populism. Is there not? I mean, isn't that a part of the American tradition?
Oh, yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that, you know, we've been talking about a lot of historical examples of populism that are more on the right,
yes.
And that's, you know, that makes sense because, you know, the Tea Party is so powerful right now. But you're absolutely correct that populism is not an inherently right-wing approach to politics at all. In fact, I think when you just sort of be intuitively, I think a lot of people would expect populism to be, if anything, more likely to be on the left, because it tends to be a movement of the less powerful banding together to try to counteract what they see as the power of a smaller group. And when we think of values of equality and general egalitarianism and a skepticism towards social hierarchies, I think that we think of the left wing. And yeah, there are definitely examples. You know, I think in some ways, if we go back just a few years to 2011, and I guess it was the end of 2011 to 2012, the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Right.
you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement's a lot more was a lot more disorganized and complicated, and I think ideologically varied than the Tea Party movement. But at the same time, I think what's definitely true, I would find it really hard to argue against this, is that the Occupy movement was really profoundly populist in a way that even the Tea Party isn't, because, you know, the populism ethic, or ethos rather, was embedded in the very organizational structure of Occupy. Occupy's populism and egalitarianism was so genuinely felt and so considered so important to its identity that basic decision making was often made, was almost exclusively made through kind of just raw democracy, often not even pure democracy, but with a goal towards unanimity. So we don't have to go back that far to find a left-wing example of populism. It's definitely not inherently right-wing.
For sure. Now I certainly agree the Occupy movement was, and I have to put it in the past tense because I don't see it now, the decision-making process. I've been in organizations in the past where consensus had to be reached, and there were consensus blockers, and you can't get anything done. You cannot get anything done. And I wonder, you know, the people have said in preparation for this show that, well, we have a populist left. It's called Occupy Wall Street. Do you sense a need for and development of some alternative, something that might be more, you know, able to stick out through the long term?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people who would say that the Tea Party already was, I mean, sorry, that the Occupy was already the left-wing Tea Party, I don't think it's quite right, and I think that what you mentioned about how the emphasis on consensus is actually kind of important towards understanding why that comparison is imperfect. Because the one thing I tried to emphasize in my article that I think is important, and this is a controversial position, so you know, there's very smart people who disagree with me on this, but I believe that one of the main sources of the Tea Party's strength and effectiveness has been its willingness to basically work within the system, in the sense that they don't spend much time talking about revolution. I mean, they talk about revolution in the sense of its powerful political, powerful political rhetoric, but their talk of revolution is mainly figurative. They're not actually imagining kind of a fundamental reorganization of government and society. But that was much more common with the Occupy Wall Street movement. And while I think there are a lot of things to say in favor of that approach, it makes it a lot more difficult to force for the Occupy their most natural ally, even though this is more of a relative thing, was the Democratic Party. But if your basic position is that working with the Democratic Party is tantamount to selling out, it makes it really hard, I think, in the present context at least, to effectively create change, because like it or not, we've got two parties and they run the country, and in terms of concrete major policy changes, if you want to get them done, by no means do you need to work exclusively with the political parties, but you can't ignore them either.
I couldn't agree more, and a lot of people have talked along those lines. I mean, let's face it, the populist right may have talked about a third party, but they never did form a third party, because it seems pretty clear they could see that a very powerful structure already existed, and it was kind of there for the taking, and they have been largely successful at that. And an old friend of mine, Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation, has long argued that we have to work within the Democratic Party. And as you mentioned, some people say, oh, horrors, no, you can't work within the Democratic Party. Let's face it, the Democratic Party is, I mean, heck, they're corporate owned as well. I mean, they're you know, and they'd get their money from the same place. But then again, Paul Wellstone proudly said he was from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And there is parenthetically reason to believe that Dick Cheney had him killed, but that's another story. Now, Howard Dean used that same phrase, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, in 2004 fairly successfully. What is the status of that wing now, that, you know, populist Democratic wing of the Democratic Party?
Yes. So I think that the populist wing or of the Democratic Party, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, as Howard Dean liked to say, I think that right now, certainly the prevailing narrative coming out of D.C. and sort of the typical mainstream political reporter's take on the issue is going to be that that section of the Democratic Party is right now ascendant in a way that it hasn't been in some time. I think that there's some truth to that. I mean, certainly, you know, the most obvious example, I think, would be Senator Elizabeth Warren,
yes,
who is, I think most people would agree, is really a unabashed and vocal, unashamed economic liberal in a way that we call generally populist, because she is so skeptical or downright antagonistic towards Wall Street. So her success is certainly a reason to the claim that kind of the left of the Democratic Party is rising, as people have also pointed to New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Right.
Some people have also pointed to, even though he predates these two, those two people by a couple years, but Florida Congressman Alan Grayson. There are definitely people within the Democratic Party who are, you know, more left-wing than, you know, Hillary Clinton, who are succeeding. At the same time, I don't want to take it too far because, as I said in my piece, you know, Elizabeth Warren comes from Massachusetts. That's not a conservative state.
Right.
And Bill de Blasio comes from New York City, which, while it spent much of the past, really, generation being governed by either a Republican and Giuliani or a Republican and then independent, who's basically, within the context of New York City politics, a Republican and,
sure,
and Michael Bloomberg.
Oh, yeah.
The key thing is New York City context, and so a Republican in New York City is generally a Democrat anywhere else. So I think that we can't go too far, and we can't declare victory quite yet for people who want the left wing of the Democratic Party to seize control. But at the same time, I think it's very obvious that that's where the energy is within the party right now. That's where the ideas are coming from, and that's where activists are most excited and most passionate, and within politics, numbers are obviously important, but as I'm sure since you've been an organizer and been part of organizing, you know very well, you know, a small group of people who have a lot more passion and dedication than a large group can often get a lot more done.
That's very much true. It's that, as we all know, never doubt the power of a small group of dedicated people. You just tuned in. Our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show, Elias Iskwith, assistant editor at Salon, who were discussing his recent article, A Left-Wing Tea Party May Be Closer Than You Think. And it does seem, and you use the term movement, that the Tea Party is not just a public relations gimmick. It's not just candidates. They use candidates, but it's a lot more than that. What concerns me about, you know, traditional liberals within the Democratic Party, which, by the way, the party itself has pretty much always taken liberals for granted, but that people within the Democratic Party tend to go for, you know, a knight in shining armor to come and rescue, you know, and it's much more sexy and attractive to go at the federal level, you know, but the idea of just working at the state and local level the right wing has done that. The Tea Party has done that. How important is that? And do you see, you know, going beyond the heroes like Elizabeth Warren and Bill de Blasio and Bernie Sanders and other people like that, you know, because heroes ain't going to do it by themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really, the point you raise is really important. And it's something that I feel that people on the left are starting to appreciate it more than maybe they did, let's say, 6 years ago. But it's still a lesson that the right has so far done a better job internalizing than the left, which is that if you want to get things done in American politics, you, as much as important as the presidency is, and it is extremely important,
oh, yes,
it is essential, but it is not sufficient, is the way I would put it. You need to have a broad-based movement with many people and with a real kind of infrastructure to it, to be able to support candidates that either challenge people within their own party who they want to move more further along the ideological spectrum, or to just simply withstand the attacks from the other side. You need something more than just a Barack Obama, an Elizabeth Warren, a Bernie Sanders. You need to have something more along the lines of what the Tea Party has, which is large networks of nonprofit or think tank or simple advocacy organizations that have, kind of labyrinthine connections with one another, and have they sort of created their own alternative political ecosystem, in a sense, where you can come up through the right wing on a very local level, and without ever leaving that that community, you can eventually find your way working on Capitol Hill if you're so inclined and if you're talented and lucky and so forth. And the left doesn't really have that right now. I mean, traditionally, the heart of the kind of movement or the infrastructure that the left has relied on has been organized labor. And while organized labor is still extremely important towards for Democratic Party get out the vote efforts, as Monday's Supreme Court ruling Harris versus Quinn, which found that which basically weakened the bargaining power of public employees without quite destroying it altogether, although it looks like the judges, the conservative majority, set the groundwork for doing that soon. As that example shows, the labor really for a long time, for you could say even going back to like 1947, has been on the defensive in American politics. And that makes it a lot harder for the left and the Democratic Party to maintain the kind of broad or large system that spans local, state, and federal politics, and to keep up with the right wing in that regard, because they don't have as many troops on the ground, to use kind of a crude metaphor.
Well, it does seem to be true, and there's that bumper sticker: think globally, act locally. The Tea Party has gotten that. They have a long tradition of getting involved in school board races and town councils and working on specific local issues. The left hasn't been doing that as well, although if you look back far enough in history, that has been the case. And a lot of the political dynamics these days, I mean, let's face it, Barack Obama would not have been elected without young people. There are a lot of young people today, people who are really solely responsible for electing Barack Obama. They must now feel terribly betrayed and used by his manipulation of the word hope. Did Obama cause liberals to lose this generation? Or what do you think might actually work again to connect with and inspire young people? How, there's an awful lot of them.
Yeah, the role that young people play within the Democratic Party coalition is very important, and you're absolutely right that, especially, excuse me, in 08,
yeah,
he, Obama did a really kind of a historic job in terms of motivating young people and organizing them. And a lot of young people are quite understandably very disappointed 6 years later. I don't think that we're quite at the point where we need to worry about losing, where liberals need to worry about losing a generation of young people. Not so much because the Obama presidency has secretly been enormously successful or anything like that, but more because the Republican Party right now is so, and the right-wing movement in general right now is so, as much as young people may not like the Democratic Party, they hate the Republican Party.
True.
And in a weird way, while there are many, many, many problems, I think, with the two-party system for people who support kind of progressive politics, there's almost reason to be relieved that young people have only one other option. They look at the Republican Party and recoil, as they do. I think that we should not expect to see young people as motivated for a candidate as they were for Obama in 2008 for a long time. I mean, I think you could argue that's a once-in-a-generation type moment. But I wouldn't say yet that we need to worry that they're going to abandon politics entirely, because what you see when you look at the Pew Research Center has done a lot of great studies, Harvard, the Kennedy School of Politics has done great studies of young voters as well, and what they find is while young voters don't like the Democratic Party and loathe the Republican Party, when you ask them their views on specific issues or even their kind of general political philosophy, it's considerably more left-wing than the rest of the country. Young people tend to be dramatically more in favor of LGBTQ rights than the rest of the country. They tend to be considerably more racially tolerant and progressive than the rest of the country. And the point that I think is most important within the context of American politics, arguably, is that young people, when they're asked if they want a government that does more and is consequently bigger versus a government that is smaller and does less, and just as an aside, I think that there's all sorts of reasons to challenge that framing, but that's the framing that we have. Even with that imperfect framing that I would argue is sort of in some sense tilted against the left, young people are dramatically more likely than the rest of the country to say that they want a government that is bigger and does more than one that is smaller and does less. This was true when Obama was elected, and even after these five or so, I think most people would say disappointing years, those numbers still hold up. The number of young people who want bigger government is still significantly greater. So I think that for people who are worried that we're losing or that the left is losing a generation, that's an important thing to keep in mind and gives you reason to be optimistic that just generally going forward, there will still be significant, profound areas of agreement between young people and the left that can be built on.
I sure hope so. I wonder about that. I mean, I'm looking back to 2004 when John Kerry, the best thing he had going for him was he was not George Bush. That was not enough to get people enthusiastic. You've got to get, at least in my opinion, people really enthusiastic. And, a lot of people on the traditional liberal side of the Democratic Party are really disgusted with the corporate-owned, hawkish, centrist Democratic Party establishment. And the center has obviously moved to the right. They see what looks like the inevitability of Hillary Clinton, who is a person who has supported the war, favors Keystone XL, is fine with letting Monsanto take over agriculture, and of course is a favorite of the old boys on Wall Street. Is she the Democratic Party now? Can it be wrestled from that, old boy network of which she is a big part?
I would say...
And it's a tough one.
It is a tough one. I would say probably not. If the goal is to have the forces within the party that we generally, or people on the left of the party, tend to associate with Hillary Clinton no longer in control. I don't think the chances of that are very good, because for lots of reasons, one of which being we live in a you know, our system is in some pretty fundamental ways geared towards maintaining the power of wealthy capitalists.
Yes.
And you know, the Democratic Party is very much part of the system. So the chances, I think, of really having kind of the left of the Democratic Party run it are not great. But one place where I think that there is real reason for optimism, and it's more than just a silver lining, is that to go back to what you mentioned, and you're absolutely right about John Kerry, that his biggest, for liberals at least, his biggest appeal was that he wasn't George W. Bush, and that's not really saying so much. The big difference is that in really significant ways, this is a different country than it was in 2004, just in the sense of who lives here and who votes. It's a younger, it's getting, the electorate is younger than it was, it's less white than it was, and as I mentioned before, consequently, it's more ideologically liberal than it was. So Democrats don't need to focus so much as they used to throughout the Clinton, Kerry, and during the 80s, too, during all those eras. They don't need to worry so much about kind of picking up the votes of what we tend to call Reagan Democrats. These are people who are culturally conservative. Economically, they don't think of themselves necessarily as the same as the Wall Street people, but for various reasons, Ronald Reagan was able to appeal to this, what was seen for a while as a crucial block of voters. They tend to be white male and often Southern. That group is now completely under the control of the Republican Party, so to some degree, the Democrats can't worry about them, because it's a lost cause, especially when you have a candidate like Barack Obama. Which brings me to Hillary Clinton. Generally, Hillary Clinton would be someone that we would associate with trying to reach out to Reagan Democrats.
Yes.
Remember during the 08 primary, that ended up being her de facto strategy as she started losing ground to Obama. She started running as sort of a cultural conservative, drinking beer with mothers in rural Pennsylvania and so forth. But the thing is, because I strongly believe that politics is fundamentally about groups of people. Politicians matter a lot, but I think politicians are creatures of that respond very much to incentives. That because the Democratic Party, I believe, is more, the people within the Democratic Party are more liberal than they were 10 years ago, and because I think Hillary Clinton is such a consummately political person, I think that there's reason to believe that what liberals can do right now is try to box her in to supporting liberal policies. And there's certainly reasons to be skeptical of that. You could worry that Clinton will act as, I think people would say, the governor of my state, Andrew Cuomo, has, and make agreements and promises and then break them. One thing to keep in mind is there's a political writer, political scientist named Jonathan Bernstein, who's worth reading, and he wrote this during the 2012 election, but it's something I always keep in mind. He's found that actually what presidents say they're going to do when they're campaigning is overwhelmingly what they end up actually doing, or at least trying to do, if they win office. When he was making this argument, he was trying to push back on people who would say, yes, Mitt Romney is talking like he's far right, but look at his record in Massachusetts. He'll govern that way more as a moderate. And Bernstein says, well, no, if you look at the record, whatever Mitt Romney's saying now that he's out on the campaign trail is in all likelihood what he's going to try to do. I think we can try to rely on that same dynamic with Hillary Clinton and try to make sure that when she's campaigning in 2016, you know, obviously we're both assuming that she will be, but I think that it's pretty hard to imagine a different scenario. I think there's reason to believe that when she's campaigning in 2016, liberals can try to make sure that what she's campaigning on are the types of policies that they care about. So raising the minimum wage, strengthening unions, fighting wage theft, improving the ability of workers in the state system to organize, and so forth. I think that there's reason to be optimistic about those things, but you know, again, this is not a hard science.
That's for sure,
to say the least. So, for people who feel like Hillary Clinton is just more of the same, I can't really tell them that she's secretly some big lefty, because I don't think she is.
Right.
The best I can say is that while democracy in America is far from robust, at least within the party systems, not a complete myth.
Yeah, that does seem to be the case. And I believe it was Bob Borisage who wrote that politics and protest are both necessary, neither is sufficient. And
yes.
And I'm sure you've heard the story when the legendary labor and civil rights leader A. Philip Randolph met with Franklin Roosevelt to get the president to take action against discrimination. The president allegedly told him, "I agree with you. I want it to happen. Now go out and make me do it." And it seems that even though history is full of examples of change only coming from pressure at the grassroots level, Americans today oftentimes feel more powerless than ever and have pretty much accepted their sense of powerlessness. What can actually work to fire people up to go out and make the politicians do it? I mean, before you answer that, maybe, I was going to point out that the Tea Party was very effective this way when they ousted House Majority Leader Cantor. I mean, the Wall Street Journal wrote that of Cantor, since he was first elected to Congress, Mr. Cantor has been Wall Street's go-to guy on issues big and small. He was a top recipient of Wall Street donations, and he regularly stood up for the banks, securities firms, insurance companies. There's some kind of sense that there is this split that the Tea Party has used anger at this, but and the Democrats haven't. So I wonder if, getting back to the question, how can people on the left particularly get a sense of powerfulness again, or some sense of I mean, I think Americans generally feel more powerless than our European counterparts.
I think it's an interesting question. Just on that last point, I don't know. I would definitely be interested to see some more. I think that there could be some reason for the many flaws of the American system. We don't have anything quite like the EU, where public policy is just completely opposite from what
people
show people want. You know, the austerity that the EU has been pushing for the past 4 years or so, which has been pretty devastating, I think, to the continent. But to your bigger, more important point of what people can do to both cultivate and harness that kind of populist energy, there are things that people can do. I think that, as you mentioned, primary challenges, I think, are vital. I think they're a great tool. I think if there's one lesson, at least tactically, that left-wing people should take from the right, it's that primary challenges are a very powerful weapon, and one of the few that they have at their disposal, activists to really force people running the political parties to, at the very least, toe the line that they want. So I think that anything that involves either a challenge within the primary system, or a challenge within the primary system, or a challenge, be it maybe even third party, depending on your context. You know, in some places, like in California, there's no longer kind of party based voting; it's just total vote allocation. And anything like that's within the primary process. I mean, what people can do in those situations is find candidates who have a conceivable mainstream appeal. So I would recommend that people on the left look for candidates who are, you know, more like Elizabeth Warren, who has a very sort of traditional red-blooded American biography. And to stay away from people, you know, he won, David Bratt, the man who Cantor, he won, but, you know, if you actually look at his positions and his writings, he's really, really out there. So I would recommend that, in general, that left-wing activists and people within the Democratic Party want to make sure that they're pushing their leaders to stay left, are looking for kind of accessible candidates who are willing to engage in losing battles for the sake of winning the war. And that's really important. I mean, one relatively recent example of primaries working within the Democratic Party and not just sort of on the small local level where you don't see these things happening, mm-hmm. although, as we both agree, they're very important. When former Senator Lance Blinken from Arkansas was running for re-election, I believe this was in 2010, she got challenged by the lieutenant governor of the state from the left.
Mm-hmm.
She was widely seen, I think justifiably, as sort of a really corporate Democrat, one who frequently went against what I think we generally think of as Democratic values. But because she was afraid of this primary challenge, sort of on a dime, she started proposing, this was the period when Dodd-Frank was being written still, she started proposing some really strong regulations on the banks, specifically on, I believe, the amount of capital reserves they had to have if they wanted to. I might be wrong about this. The point is, she pushed some very strong kind of Wall Street regulation, and this was not a politician who had any reputation for caring about those issues at all. But because she saw a threat from her left, she made that, she put forward that policy, and crucially, the Dodd-Frank's final version on was to the left of where it likely would have been if not for Blanche Lincoln's proposal. And I think that tells you a lot because, again, Blanche Lincoln would never be confused for Elizabeth Warren.
No, that's for sure. I have this sense that there is a real untapped potential for populists on the left and right to get together. We share a mistrust of the government supporting the big banks, the government keeping corporate welfare, the NSA spying, which the Democrats don't even seem to want to talk about at all. But I think people on the left and right, civil libertarians, care about this. And I don't see any linkage happening, but boy, I'll tell you, I see a real potential. But maybe this is happening. I mean, there are specific issues that people who are, you know, kind of left out on the right and left can maybe get together and, I don't know, have some movement, make some movement for the country. Your thoughts?
I mean, I think you're right that there's, you know, one of the funny things about American politics is we are a country that is extremely polarized, but when you actually dig into the public opinion polling, you'll find that when you talk to people and you try to kind of bracket whether they consider themselves Republicans or Democrats, liberals or conservatives, and you just try to talk to them specifically about certain issues, that we're not as polarized in some sense as you would think. A lot of people, for example, Pew came out recently with a really fascinating in-depth study, which was last week, of Americans' views on various issues. And what they found is that a lot of very conservative people are actually totally okay with certain gun control measures that generally we think of as liberal and divisive. And, you know, the explanation for why there's sort of the disconnect between what voters will actually say when asked about an issue and the actual results of the electoral process, I mean, that's a whole nother show. That's a whole nother series of shows, in fact. But what it shows you is that there are certain places where if organizers can try to just relentlessly focus on the issue, not the broader partisan dynamic, not the culture war, but just that issue, that there is room for kind of cross-ideological alliances. You know, as I'm sure you know, this is something that I believe Ralph Nader just wrote a book about. He feels very strongly that there's a potential here for. I mean, I think he takes it a little too far, but it's worth talking about. He thinks that there's a place for Tea Party people and left-wing people who both kind of hate corporate dominance of our government to come together in favor of, in a sense, actual free markets and real competition for these corporate behemoths. So, you know, on that issue, as you said, on the NSA, certainly. The NSA is something that, you know, the number of people who really support the program when you explain it to them is quite small.
Yeah, for sure. But Democrats haven't taken advantage of it yet.
Corporations, things also like the internet censorship, access to the internet, and basically anything you kind of think of as public goods that people see as being overtaken or distorted by corporate power. You know, there's real organizing to be done there, and if people are interested in that, I would definitely recommend they check out the activism and the writing of Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig, he just started, along with actually a Republican, a super PAC, and the goal of the super PAC is to change the way we fund policies, we fund politics in such a way that we won't need super PACs. And that's the kind of thing that I think is worth paying attention to, because when it comes to just the idea that there's too much concentrated money in our politics, you can find very conservative people who will agree wholeheartedly.
I totally agree with you, and I am not on the far right. If people are interested in following your work, Elias Isquith, go to Cell On. You have articles there with some regularity. Thank you so much for being with us. Very informative and some degree of optimism. All right, thank you.
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this darkness. I can't feel nothing but this chain that binds me. Lost track of how far I've gone. How far I've gone, how high I've climbed. On my back's a 60-pound stone. On my shoulder, half mile of line.